The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Welcome to The Debrief. We're going to look back on some of the big stories of the week. I'm joined by Mick Clifford with the Irish Examiner, Jane Matthews, political reporter with The Journal, and Aideen Finnegan, who's presenter of the Better With Money podcast with The Irish Times. And you're all welcome. Thank you for coming in today. Now, earlier in the week, we had a discussion around GAA, free-to-air, the fact that a lot of the games were not free-to-air last weekend and people had to pay on the streaming service. Does it bother you, Mick?
I'll be honest with you, Claire. No, I mean, last weekend I was in Croke Park.
But I have to say,
to be fair, like, I'll just give you an example. 2 weeks previously, I wanted to watch the Kerry Armagh match, and I was working in London for the Examiner, and I managed to be able to watch it in my hotel room in stifling heat because of GAA Plus. And basically, that brought home to me, because I haven't lived abroad for a long number of years, the importance of it in particular for the so-called diaspora. The other element to it is all the money in the GAA, to the greatest extent, goes back into the game, unlike professional sport organisations. And so from that point of view, I don't have a big problem with it. The only issue that would arise, and I don't think it's a big issue, is people who have issues around technology, particularly older people, and tuning into it. And there is something there, but surely we're still living in a scenario whereby somebody in the community can help out people like that in one form or another.
Yeah, because we had Colm O'Rourke on the programme talking about it, and we think we arrived at the conclusion at the end of our conversation that maybe when you get to quarterfinal stage in the championship, that really those kind of games should be on the telly.
There's an argument for that. There's an argument for that.
So that everybody can see them. And it's nearly like, it's a give back, isn't it, to all of the, I know that argument has been made time and time again, to all of the volunteers around the country, but I do think there's something in it. You know, the people who are going out on a wet Tuesday night to train young girls and boys, that really, to expect them to pay, I don't know, how do the rest of you feel about it?
I mean, I have to start out at the outset and say I'm not a big GAA person. When people I meet go to a family event and they'll say, oh, Kildare is playing today. And I'm like, oh, are they? Oh, really? I don't know. But I do sort of feel like any organisation that is in receipt of that much taxpayers' money and public funding, kind of onus is on you to kind of provide that stuff then to the grassroots, isn't it? Isn't that what the money is there for?
What do you think?
Yeah, I think I'm in a similar position to Aideen, but I am a lathe woman, so I'm a big GAA person for the next month. But no, I think, I guess my gut instinct on this was like, it should be free to air. It's our national sport. It's a, you know, the players don't get paid, and it's such an integral part of our culture in that. But then when you do think about it, there's such a massive amount of games that they do need to broadcast. And like, my partner is from Donegal. He was trying to watch a Donegal and Cork match recently, I think. And it actually wasn't even on GAA Go. It wasn't on RTE. So he was forced to listen to it on the radio. And it was kind of like being back in the olden days. So I think maybe
nothing wrong with the radio now, Jane.
No.
That is an example, though, of the fact that sometimes there are so many matches that, in the first instance, the national broadcaster or Virgin wouldn't be able to do them alone anyway, so you have to have some other entity there for that alone, like, to be fair to them. I mean, there is, as you say, Claire, there is an argument about the quarterfinal stage, but generally speaking, grassroots people who are involved in the association, I think, don't have a massive problem with it. It's more people who would like to tune in anyway, because as people say, it's a national sport. No, that's fair enough. But at the same time, there's so much of it going on, I think it's a small price to pay. I mean, I got three matches for 20-something euro, which...
Oh, you didn't pay the 85 for the year?
No.
Right. So you got how many? Three for...
I was 20-something.
Because it was 15 euro a game for the, if you wanted to watch one of the quarterfinals.
Yeah, on its own. Which is a bit... It's a bit pricey.
A little bit. Listen, let's move on to the minimum wage, because some of the employers' organisations were warning that if the minimum wage goes up again in 2027, they will just not be able to employ people. Now, we know that the official figures tell us that the increasing minimum wage hasn't affected numbers and that jobs have not been lost, but it's whether jobs have been created. It's just over 14 euro, Jane, isn't it, for an adult worker, so someone over the age of 19.
Yeah, and I think it was an interesting argument that didn't really make sense to me this week from Retail Excellence Ireland, and they were saying that it's going to impact them being able to employ younger people and give them their first jobs. And it, that doesn't really hold water, because if you're under 20, you don't get paid the minimum wage anyway. You get about 70% of it. So I think that's a bit of a boogeyman that the industry is trying to put out there. And look, I mean, obviously, small businesses are under so much pressure at the moment since COVID, with rising costs. There's lots of things there around the, you know, pension contributions and things like that as well. But I think to go after the minimum wage and kind of try and say that it means, you know, your daughter or your niece or nephew or whatever isn't going to get their first job, it doesn't really make sense to me. I don't
Does
think
it make
very
sense
strong
to you,
argument.
Aideen?
Well, do you know what? It doesn't. I feel like the minimum wage is often used as a bogeyman, as you say. I remember sort of in the years following the financial crash, just getting chatting to someone who worked for one of the banks. And obviously the banks were persona non grata at the time, you know. And they said, no, it's the minimum wage that caused all that hassle. And I was kind of like, oh, that's interesting. All right. But I do notice that the Economic and Social Research Institute carried out some research that they published in March. And they found that 10 successive increases to the minimum wage adopted here between 2016 and 2025 did not coincide with higher likelihood of employees becoming unemployed.
Yeah, but job creation is what the employer organisations would say it affects. So people are not losing their jobs, but they're not creating their jobs. And we had Finbar Filan on, who owns retail businesses, and he said this increase is leading to them investing more in automated checkouts.
I'm just not sure about that, because I think if they're going... I think they're going to do that anyway. I think they're going to invest in automation where they can anyway.
Mick, what do you think of the argument?
I think you can project job creation in any way. Suppose this is going to affect job creation. So what's your projection of job creation? What ends up being created? I think, look, it still is not at a level of a living wage. It's getting there. But the point about it is, do we want an economy that, like they have in the USA, where a huge cohort of people working in areas like retail are also on receipt of food stamps in order to work is not paying enough for people to survive. And having small increases like this is the very least I think we can do in that respect. You're never going to have a scenario whereby you've wage increases and an employer is going to say, oh, we very much welcome paying our employees more. So it's all down on one level to how well things are lobbied, to be quite
honest.
Well,
they're firing a shot across the bows of the Low Pay Commission, but the Low Pay Commission's ambition is, and that is a government decision, is to have a living wage.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is should be only going one way, really.
Exactly.
It's to give people a decent
standard
of living.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, we're constantly told we're living in one of the wealthiest countries in the world. We're certainly living in one of the best functioning economies in Europe. And to say that we can't, at the very minimum, give people enough money in work to survive on some basic level, I mean, you know, it's not on, to be honest.
We had David McCourtin during the week, and he's made this documentary about what's happened in America. You know, with this division, you know, you're either very left or you're very right. And a lot of that, in his eyes, is stemming from the fact that people can't afford to live on the wages that they're being paid. Just as you said there, you know, you're doing a job, you're working full-time hours, and yet you just cannot make ends meet. Now, if we look at that example, we've got to ask ourselves, is that where we want to go?
I mean, just in terms of everything that has happened in terms of American politics, a very basic example is the person, the man, the woman who were working in the factory, they had a secure job, they had a decent pension, and they had the prospect of their kids going to college and going one better, etc. That person now might be working in retail on an hourly wage, no security, on food stamps. That's the way it has gone so much in that American-style economy and the way things have divided over the last 30 years. And as you say, do we want that here? I mean, is that really where we're at?
It's like, a cautionary tale, isn't it?
Yeah.
And then the other development in that sector was the VAT rate cut for hospitality. I mean, was there ever a VAT rate cut that was more controversial, Jane? Like, we have had so many commentators, mostly economists, saying this was not needed. And then the entire hospitality industry saying, yes, it was, hanging on by our fingernails, waiting for the 1st of July in order to survive, we needed this reduction.
Yeah, it just shows the power of a big lobby group, I guess, doesn't
it? Do you
it?
Think, or was it needed?
I mean, obviously, like we were saying earlier, there is so many small businesses that have been struggling. I was looking there was a report from PwC this week, and they were saying hospitality insolvencies in the first half of this year are actually down 25% on the same period last year. So you can make the argument that, no, maybe it wasn't really needed. The government have said this is going to be in place now for the rest of their term anyway. We'll wait and see what happens after the next election. I would imagine most other parties in the Dáil maybe wouldn't want to be keeping it at this level. I mean, there was a lot of controversy around the fact you'll have a lot of multinationals benefiting from this. And this was something the Taoiseach was asked about at the launch during the week, and he kind of defended it by saying that, like, the likes of McDonald's and Domino's and other multinational companies in Ireland, they are often franchises, and it's Irish, you know, it's people in Ireland that own these businesses and operate them. So he was kind of saying, well, it makes sense in that sense. But I think, I mean, you would imagine any more disruption to the economy that there would be massive pushback on that for people to think that the likes of McDonald's are benefiting hugely from this VAT cut. Like, it's costing, next year it's going to cost $681 million just for this cut alone. I mean,
yeah, it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
Like, in the context of the budget and people hoping that they might get a tax cut in the budget, that's a lot of money to spend on one sector, isn't it?
Huge amount. Like, I mean, do you remember the fuel cuts that were announced? That package was, I think, $750 million. So, and everyone was remembers how monumental it was. So this is in the same ballpark. It is quite, not over the same time frame, obviously, but it's a huge amount of money. And I think the argument is that that is money that should be ring-fenced and targeted towards poorer households who don't go out and spend money in food services because they don't have it.
The CSO stats for the start of the year showed that close downs in hospitality had reduced. But then when you talk to anyone in the hospitality sector, they say, yes, that's because we were clinging on to get to July to get the VAT cut.
I think they also, I think from what I understand, the closures of a restaurant can be very high profile. But that's kind of the peg that it's hung on, you know, that this cause is hung on. But that actually, it's just part of the general attrition in that sector.
Exactly. And the fact we don't hear anything near as much about the restaurants that are being opened and the retail outlets in that respect, there's a high turnover in it. There's no question. I mean, it was an exercise in brilliant lobbying, but it also fed into the idea, in terms of politically the way we do things in this country, that the better you lobby, the more expertly you lobby, the louder you can shout, therefore your interests will be looked after more than others. And I think that's corrosive, and I think it was definitely a mistake. It fed into largely to Fine Gael's adherence to promoting business, which is grand of itself, that's fine, but that seems to have been the driver rather than it being going where it was most needed, the way the economy is developing at the moment.
All right, and it does affect the maths around budget 2027.
Yeah, you know, exactly. No,
these things are always about choices, aren't they?
Exactly.
So some messages coming in on the minimum wage. If the minimum wage goes up, it will go up for all levels, including those paid at 70% of the rate. That's the younger workers, the 19-year-olds and 17-year-olds. Paying the sub-minimum wage is not something any retailer should be aspiring to. It's optional, but it is a poor reflection on an employer. And on the GAA, if it's free to air for everyone on TV, why not free entry to everyone into the stadium? That would be logical. But then somebody says to us, I'm a farmer, and there's something magical about listening to the GAA on the radio in the tractor or the milking parlour on a beautiful summer's day. I have to say, at the weekend when I was sort of forced to listen to the commentary on the radio, that is true. It does take you back. There's a bit of nostalgia there.
Absolutely.
As well, isn't there?
I mean, unfortunately, there's no one that matches me, Oliver Hurty, but there are plenty of very good commentators, and it is, there's a fantastic buzz off it.
Now, we are holding the presidency of the EU here in Ireland since the 1st of July, which was the day before yesterday. It feels like it's been going on forever, but anyway, it hasn't. It's only the 1st of July. And I was saying to you when I come in, it does feel, doesn't it, Aideen, like nothing is going to happen in domestic politics, if I can put it like that, because the focus is going to be on the wider field.
Be so busy. I mean, I was listening to my colleague Jack Power, who's based in Brussels. He was speaking to the Inside Politics podcast, and he was talking about the, you know, having to put things on the table, having to find out what different countries' positions are. Can they nudge them in this direction? Like, the amount of diplomacy that's going to go on, that's going to distract not just the ministers, but also, you know, senior civil servants and other diplomats. And so, I mean, I do think that they're going to be so busy. What if something kicks off? And it was pointed out as well that imagine if 2 weeks into the Cyprus presidency, Donald Trump said, oh, I want Greenland, and I think we're going to get it, and all hell breaks loose, you know. So there's a real unknown factor there. I mean, if Ireland is pulled in that direction to kind of concentrate on that, what happens with the ball here?
And, you know, politicians have been asked over the last couple of weeks, what does Ireland get out of this? You know, all of the money, some people say it'll cost us 300 or 400 million to host this thing. Like, I don't know what we get out of it. Like, we have to do it. We're duty bound to do it. We have no choice. It's not like we're in it for the win, right?
No, yeah. I mean, look, we're part of the EU. It rotates among all the members. It's something that you have an obligation to do. And to be fair, doing it well is something to aspire to on the basis of that soft power. It's not the people, this silly notion of being good Europeans. It's that how best you position yourself to further the interests of the country. And if in the overall context you're doing something like this well, does that on that kind of soft power basis increase your chances of getting a better deal in whatever way you want it from the EU? The other side, though, is if they're going to be chairing negotiations like the CAP, which we obviously have a very vested interest in, and more particularly anything to do with online safety, which unfortunately we're disproportionately in hock to because of the level of tech companies in the country. That's when things get a small bit sticky in terms of the actual business of the presidency.
Well, do you think that we will have a more of an influence on those matters because we're
if you're even on a temporary basis chairing the debates, that by its nature would suggest you could have a certain influence, you know, and whether you want influence, for instance, in online safety, because, you know, the government, look, let's face it, they have a Pavlovian response to the tech industry anytime they want anything, and they certainly won't be in favour of online safety, so it could be a small bit sticky in that respect.
Mm-hmm. And then we might have Donald Trump coming in the middle of it.
Exactly.
In September, isn't it, when the Open is on down in Doonbeg. What do you think the win might be or could be, Jane, or do you think there is one for Ireland?
I think it's just about keeping our reputation intact, really. I mean, it's just like
showing them a good time.
Showing them a good time, showing that we can carry off these large scale events without any hiccups or without any security issues. And I think that's going to be the real challenge for Ireland. I mean, there's been so much talk about how we just aren't equipped in the same way as some other EU countries were when it comes to having these big events and the security detail that's needed with it. I mean, like half of the money that's been budgeted to run this is going to Angarda Síochána to maintain the security of it. So I think, I mean, if it goes smoothly, grand, there won't be much said about it. But if there is any hiccups, that's where, you know, we'll really say like, oh, you know, that... That's where it'll be back in the news, you know. Otherwise, it's just run of the norm and it's
Success.
A procedural type of thing. Yeah.
A boring 6 months.
That's it.
Yeah. I don't know if you got to hear the challenge that we've set for Henry McKean over in New York. He has to get into Taylor Swift's wedding.
Wow.
And I advised him to get a job as a caterer. So he's looking into that now. But he's over there in 38 degree heat, wandering around, you know, casing all of the entrances of Madison Square Garden to see can he get anything. God help him. Like, what an assignment. Are you into this thing, though? Are you interested in it?
I was just going to say, what a fun assignment. I would love to be doing that today. Look, I'm not massively into it. I wouldn't say I'm a big Swiftie. I do love her music. Like, I did grow up listening to it as a teenager. But I think the news is just so grim. You know, it's nice to have something to distract us a little bit. And we love, as a society, we love these big weddings. And I think this is kind of like the American equivalent of a royal wedding, you know. So I think let people have their joy.
I'm still surprised. And I'm a passing fan of Taylor Swift, but I'm just really surprised that she's chosen that venue for her wedding.
It's, do you know, as wedding receptions go, and I believe it is a reception as opposed to the actual wedding.
Because that's done, apparently.
Yes,
the wedding bit is done.
How smelly.
What?
Smelly?
Well, you know, Madison Square Gardens. Like, is there not like a sticky residue
locker
of beer
rooms,
all over?
Yeah.
Locker room. Like, I don't know.
Put a castle in there and trees and pink carpet. It'll be grand. Like, it'll be lovely. It'll be lovely. But it's just not what I would have expected her to do.
No. And I'm really curious, is she letting in a select? You know, she loves her fans and she has diehard fans and all her albums have like an Easter egg for the fans in
you the think
lyrics.
She's going to let members
I
of
wonder.
The Hoi Polloi in?
I wonder.
No, that's never going to happen. I'm surprised she's doing it though on this weekend as well, and I'm just waiting for the Trump reaction.
Yes, and that's not a good move for someone who is an astute businesswoman. Doing it on the weekend of the 4th of July, America 250 and that. But I mean,
why? Because he'll get annoyed with her, or
yeah. But the whole thing, like, even what it means nationally to the whole country, like, why do you want to do it on that date? I just think I wonder, is it a good Madison Square Gardens? I've no understanding of why she wants to have it there. Somebody suggested because it'll be easy for people internationally to fly into New York. You know,
I wonder. And since you've said that, now I'm wondering, is she trolling Trump?
Maybe so. This listener says the venue is the only place where they could get complete privacy. There's a roof and they can block off the windows. And if you try to do something like Dua Lipa, you get loads of leaked pictures. It's the most private way you could do it. But this is the whole point. I don't think she's trying to be private about it. Like, going to a stadium in New York doesn't suggest to me that you're worried. Like, she could go anywhere in the world, let's face it. She could fly people onto some private island and we'd never know about it. She wants this to be public, clearly.
Yeah, event. I mean, it's the biggest stadium in New York, is it?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, look, I mean, Henry is on the job, so you know.
Yeah, I'll no be brilliant if you get
hopefully
in.
He'll get in. He's having to carry a towel around with him because it's so hot. God help him. Let's all think about poor Henry over the course of the weekend. That brings us to the end. Thank you very much for being with us, Mick and Aideen and Jane, and thank you for listening and for getting in touch with the programme throughout the day and indeed throughout the week. If you've missed anything, you can check it out on the Go Loud app. It'll all be there for you. On the team today, and huge thanks to Cormac McDonagh on sound, producers Dee King and Alex Russo. Research was by David O'Connor and Kate Gunnell. Our broadcast assistant is Anne-Marie Kane, and our editor was Denise McNamara. And
the Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.